Hello and welcome to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be looking at what turned out to be a pair of stunning election victories for the radical right in Argentina and the Netherlands, and asking the big question, can any combination of parties prevent the PVV from playing a role in the next Dutch government? It's Sunday, the 26th of November, 2023.
To be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Crooked Joe Biden.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
And joining me, as always, from the other side of the world is my co-host Sam. How are you, Sam? It does seem that every time we take a short break, be it of a week or two or several months, a lot of politics seems to take place, isn't it? I mean, we've not only got the elections, we've got the UK Autumn Statement and so many other things, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're forgetting the fact that we had a Conservative Party reshuffle, which saw the return of former Prime Minister David Cameron. So it was indeed a fortnight of shocks, I think, all round, not least in the two elections we'll be talking about today as well.
Indeed. So let's kick on with this episode by talking about the two electoral earthquakes that took place across the Atlantic that made headlines on both the Monday and the Thursday. And let's just talk about that first earthquake. And Sam, Argentina has a new president and is set to be radically different from the outgoing president, Alberto Fernandez, isn't it?
It is indeed. As we talked about a few weeks ago, this was a two-round system in Argentina. And the two candidates who progressed to this second round, which took place on Sunday of last week, a week ago today, we had Javier Milei. And we had Sergio Massa. Sergio Massa is the Peronist candidate in this election, the incumbent government candidate. He was the outgoing economy minister under Alberto Fernandez. And Javier Milei is a former TV pundit, a far-right populist. He has done interviews throughout this campaign with figures like Tucker Carlson on X. So he was the radical right candidate in this election, and he came out on top. He won this election with 55.7% of the votes to Massa's 44.3%, and in the process carried 20 of Argentina's states and the city of Buenos Aires, with Sergio Massa actually just carrying 3. So it was quite a romping victory for Javier Milei, wasn't it, Chen?
Absolutely, and I think that was my reaction. I did notice that the polls in between kind of the first round and the second round did show the gap closing. Sergio Massa started out with a lead as the polling started for the runoff, but that lead began to decline. And the last couple of polls put Javier Milei slightly ahead of Sergio Massa. And I remember the preview, Sam, where I remember saying that although I did tip Massa as a likely favorite, given that gap in the first round, I would nonetheless not be surprised if Javier Milei won. But Sam, nonetheless, 11-point margin, 55% to 44%, that is a huge margin, isn't it? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it surprised me a lot. I did predict that Sergio Massa would win this, so I was wrong. But I did think in a world where Javier Milei was winning, I think there was going to be a couple of points in it. I certainly wasn't expecting this kind of margin coming off the back of a first round, which Sergio Massa, in a surprise result, won pretty comfortably. So I think we all thought that there was going to be a similar story going on in this second round, but actually it turned out to be the complete opposite. So, Chen, I think we should ask straight up is, how did Javier Milei pull this off?
Yeah, I think that's a very big place to start, and I think a very, very understandable place to start. I think some of the things that I'm going to mention, we have talked about in our preview podcast, so I won't necessarily rehash everything, but I do think that you cannot run away from the outgoing government, of which Sergio Massa was the economy minister's, record over the last term in government. You know, we had inflation at 143% and the poverty rate exceeding 40%, for example. And as the Minister for the Economy, I find that very difficult. And I think that's what why shot in the first round was the fact that Sergio Mansa managed to top the polls amidst this hard economic environment. So I think the past 4 years, of which Sergio Mansa was a prominent face, I think in the end, he just couldn't outrun it in the end. In the first round, it was, I think, well, maybe the story in the first round there was more the evidence of the Peronist support and the Peronist ability to get its supporters out. But I think in the second round here, we are really seeing the limitations in that support, because I think looking back as well, and this is something we're going to be talking about the Netherlands later, is the role of the center-right Juntos por el Cambio coalition, where we do note that we mentioned this in the first round in the preview, is that both its candidate, Patricia Bullrich, who was the former security minister and now might be security minister again in the Milei administration, and the former president and still seen as quite a big heavyweight in the center-right, Maurizio Macri, both backed Javier Milei and in turn gave him this, what one commentator said, consistency, greater political volume and an institutional halo that he was able to therefore gather a lot more votes. And I think in the ultimate question of which candidate does Argentina's dislike the least, it turns out that potentially it was Javier Milei, because I know that if I looked at the five candidates, Sam, the Workers' Left Front had about 700,000 votes. And that, if you add it all to the Peronist candidate, that got you to half of the votes, the 2 million votes that the Peronists added between the first and second rounds. On the other hand, Javier Milei added 6 million votes. Coincidentally, 6 million was exactly the number of votes that Patricia Bullrich got. So I don't think it's a straight switch, but I do think the limits of the Peronist appeal and the Juntos por el Cambio can be seen at both relative candidates gain from the first to second round.
I think that latter point about the Juntos por el Cambio base is really important, especially if you look at on a state level, because the second most popular state in Argentina is Córdoba. Well, in Córdoba, Javier Milei in the second round won 74% of the vote. It's the second most popular state. 74% of the vote was 1.6 million votes to Sergio Massa's 573,000 votes. But if you look back to the first round, this was also Patricia Bullrich's best states in terms of raw vote numbers, because in that election, she got 500,000 votes in the first round. It was still won by Javier Milei with 770,000 and Sergio Massa had 300,000. But you see that Patricia Bullrich vote pouring into Javier Milei's column. And interestingly enough as well, it seemed like quite a lot of the vote of Juan Schiaretti, who was is the incumbent governor of Córdoba, who's actually a Peronist at heart. A lot of his votes also seem to pour into the Javier Milei column in Córdoba. And if you're getting that kind of lead, like a 50-point lead almost in the second most populous province in Argentina, that's going to be quite difficult to topple, especially when the most populous province, Buenos Aires, which traditionally has been much more Peronist, it should have been a safe haven for Sergio Massa. Well, he only won that by 1.5% of the vote and 200,000 votes. So it's not going to combat the overwhelming lead that Javier Milei was able to amass in Córdoba.
No, and I think it's very interesting that you mentioned Córdoba, because, and the fact that it was technically a Peronist candidate, but crucially, it was the they billed themselves as what I understood is the non-Kirchnerist Peronism. So Peronism is the umbrella movement, but they billed themselves as that non-Kirchnerist, much more that third way center-left tradition rather than the more left-wing tradition associated with Kirchnerism and what Sergio Massa wrapped himself in. So I think it's one of those things where it's a catch-all term, but it means a lot of different things to many people across the left. So I think that's very important to state. Sam, on just giving you some other things as well, is that you talked about what facilitated the ease of why the Juntos Corporal Cambio supporters switched over to Javier Milei. I saw as well that Mauricio Macri, himself no fan of Sergio Massa, as I explained in the previous podcast, made an effort to make Javier Milei presentable, noting that Javier Milei poses no danger and he will have to negotiate in Congress because he simply doesn't have enough votes. And in particular, he has to get, in the lower house at least, negotiate with the Juntos por el Cambio to pass any legislation. In the Senate, it'll be much more difficult because the Peronists has half the seats and there are some smaller left-wing parties there. But at least in the Chamber of Deputies, I could see the logic, Sam, if you are a Juntos por el Cambio supporter, with your candidate knocked out, if you still wanted your policies to retain a grain of influence, voting for Javier Milei seems to be the option, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we'll probably come on to talking about that balance of power in Congress, because I think that's going to be crucial into looking at how much does Javier Milei's agenda actually come to reality in Argentina, because there's been a lot of talk about how extreme some of the aspects of that ideology is, but the Congress balance of power certainly put some doubt into whether some of these policies will be able to be actioned. But I think you're absolutely right, is that there was a calculation there from Juntos por el Cambio that did seem to pay off, because we were talking after the first round that the Juntos por el Cambio coalition as a whole seemed to be a little bit divided over whether support for Javier Milei was the right thing to do or not. But you see in the raw vote numbers, and given that turnout and invalid votes didn't seem to change hugely, that most people in Juntos por el Cambio actually seem to agree with Patricia Bullrich's position, it seems.
Yeah, and I think as well, Javier Milei himself knows and seems to acknowledge the fact that the Juntos por el Cambio or the centre-right coalition play a crucial support in his election victory. He has offered, mentioned that Patricia Bullrich could be the security minister again in his administration. And because of the fact that he wants to abolish a lot of government departments, she could be an even more powerful security minister than when she was, when Mauricio Macri was the president. I also note that the man leading his economic transition team, Luis Capaldo, who is expected to become the Sergio Massa's successor as economy minister, was at one point Mauricio Macri's finance minister and his head of the central bank. So there seems to be a lot of crossover between some of those elements of Juntos por el Cambio now supporting Javier Milei in his transition to the Pink House. And one more thing I will note as well is that Javier Milei seems to have slightly moderated some of his more eye-catching announcements. Now, he still wants to close the central bank. He's declared that's non-negotiable. But I did note, for example, that Luis Capaldo, who is seen as this man who is likely to be his economy minister, has conceded that the dollarization, i.e. ditching the peso and its associated currency controls and adopting the US dollar, is only a medium-term objective. So in the short term, this pace of this radical change seems to be moderating slightly, which I think is both acknowledgement that he also needs Juntos por el Cambio, not only in the fact that to win the election, but to govern over the next 4 years.
Yeah, and Chen, just for some context, I'm going to list some of the policies that Javier Milei has talked about over the last few weeks and months, just so we can start to unpack whether we think these are realistic things to expect from his administration or not. We've got things like, as you said, the dollarization of the economy, shutdown of the central bank, reduction of the state and size of government, privatizing state energy company and the public broadcaster, putting all public works to tender to try and eliminate state spending, loosening gun restrictions, abolishing abortion, loosening restrictions on the organ markets. Do you think those are realistic things that we're going to see in Argentina over the next 4 years?
Some of them, I think, more realistic than others, like the privatization and the public works, contracts, the reorganization of government, those can take place without an act of Congress. So I don't see why that won't happen. But I do think potentially, given the Peronist dominant position in the Senate, I don't think that a lot of his social agenda will find it very difficult to pass, particularly in the Senate. So maybe on those on abortion issues, on some of the social issues like that, that could be a harder sell, I feel. But I just think it'll be just difficult overall, particularly the position of the Peronis in the Senate.
Yeah, I think you're right. And do you think, as one final question, Chen, for Javier Milei, do you think there is any risk to him at all of suffering a similar fate to Guillermo Lasso? Or do you think Argentina's politics are much more are going to give him the space to govern rather than a sort of anti-Milei Congress refusing to cooperate with him from the very beginning?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question because I tried to understand. There's literally a question I wrote here is, who is Javier Milei? He's often been branded as a Donald Trump of Argentina. Similar notable hairstyle, similar populist rhetoric. But I know Donald Trump is much more economic interventionist than Javier Milei is. And on social issues, at the very least, on the issue of abortion, Donald Trump's much more liberal than Javier Milei. So it's not a carbon copy. Instead of Guillermo Lasso, I was thinking more Pedro Castillo, you know, a left-wing president facing a removed by a right-wing Congress and a hostile right-wing Congress from the get-go. And Milei's position in the Chamber of Deputies is only 38 seats out of 257. So he is going to be facing a lot of issues. I think Guillermo Lasso in the region is also another name to bring up. I do think that it will be very difficult. And what's worse for Javier Milei is the fact that there are midterm elections in Argentina in 2 years' time in 2025, which we talked about in 2021, which gave Alberto Fernandez a very big bloody nose. I suspect a lot of hope, particularly among Argentina's young, is invested in change. And if he's unable to do that, I think that hope could really dissipate very quickly, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, well, I noticed that quite a lot of media are quite concerned in Argentina about a possible widespread backlash to this administration on the streets of Argentina. I note that Javier Milei's running mate, Victoria Villarruel, is not a particularly popular figure either. She comes from a military family and has in the past defended military figures who have been convicted of crimes against humanity from the 1976 to 1983 military rule period, and actually people are concerned about her rhetoric going into government as well. So I think when you say that this next period is going to be difficult, I think there's an element of that that's a bit of an understatement, but we will just have to see how this Congress works with Javier Milei to install policies that are very unusual for recent times in Argentina. And certainly, if people are voting for change, I think that's what they're probably going to get. And whether it pays off, I guess they'll just have to wait and see.
I think that's a very good summary, particularly in the domestic situation amidst an electorate, particularly a young electorate, that is hungry for change and rejected traditional leaders, and having been successfully able to tap that. And certainly on the domestic...
I think I saw Chern in the first round. Didn't Javier Milei win nearly 50% of the under-29s votes? I think it was something like that. I've not seen equivalent figures for the second round, but that's quite astonishing in a round where overall he only got 30% of the vote.
And it's rare as well for right-wing figures to get such a high
vote
amongst the young as well. And you know, part of it was that he ran a campaign purely, a lot of it on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and so that he could connect with a young in Argentina, which feels frustrated and discontented with 20 years equipped basically of Kirchnerism. So I think that was very successful. But I'm curious, Sam, we talked about domestic policy. I want to talk about foreign policy for a little bit, because I noted within 24 hours, Donald Trump, for example, is attending Javier Milei's inauguration. Jair Bolsonaro is going to be there, and Javier Milei has endorsed Donald Trump for election in 2024. What do you think is the impact of this Argentinian victory, both on Argentina's foreign relations? Because, for example, he has called China assassins and Brazil under President Luiz Inciano Lula da Silva as communist. And what is the longer term impact electorally? Could this be a humdinger for Bolsonaro's return in 3 years' time and Trump's next year, you reckon?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think a lot of countries who had pretty reasonable relationships with Alberto Fernandez's administration might reassess where the, how they approach Argentina with Javier Milei in charge. I know Joe Biden's administration is particularly nervous about it, but both Tony Blinken and Joe Biden and Ursula von der Leyen on the European Commission side put out statements congratulating Javier Milei. So there has been attempts to make overtures to Javier Milei, but I wonder if we're going to see something very similar to what happened with Giorgia Meloni in Italy, which is a lot of the rhetoric in the campaign doesn't hugely translate into government policy, and countries find it much easier to work with them when they're working on foreign policy decisions because they were playing to their domestic base, not necessarily their international allies, when trying to win the election. And whether things change, I'm not sure. I mean, Giorgia Meloni, I think, was much more willing to work within the system than Javier Milei seems to be. I mean, he was chainsaw wielding for a lot of his campaign appearances to just symbolise how much he wanted to tear up both the state and how Argentina conducts its politics. So it might be very different, but quite often we do see that people find it much easier to have those foreign relations once they're actually in government and having to make those relationships, because Argentina is not an insignificant country in the world or in the region of South America. So for a lot of countries, the US and Canada in particular, Argentina is a very strong and important ally. So I don't particularly see Javier Milei is a figure standing too much in the way of that.
And particularly if he surrounds with administration with Patricia Bullrich and Luis Capaldo, who I said was Macri's finance minister, he's more
they're people they can
upon...
work with. Yeah.
Exactly. These are people in which Wall Street knows, they have worked with them before in the previous administration, much more moderate. I know, for example, Lula da Silva is attending. Milei has offered an invitation to Lula da Silva to attend his inauguration. And he did send well wishes to the Chinese people and President Xi Jinping as well. So you're already beginning to see a little bit of this moderation. But then again, you know, there was the talk as well, Donald Trump in between until he was sworn in or being moderate. And it could be argued that a lot of his policies still stayed true. So I think the old adage will apply, isn't it? Time will only tell what will happen over the next 4 years, isn't it? But it's going to be a roller coaster. I think we can both guarantee that.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. We'll now be moving on to talk about the Netherlands, who... Chern, your last question in the section about Argentina was whether people will be concerned that this is a harbinger that, yeah, Bolsonaro might return or Donald Trump might win re-election next year. Well, I think if one case wasn't enough to suggest that that's potentially on the cards, I think certainly... left-wing or more establishment people across the world might be feeling slightly more concerned after Thursday's election in the Netherlands, which was won by Geert Wilders of the PVV, of the Freedom Party, the perennial far-right option in Dutch politics, won this election with 37 seats out of the 150 seats in the House of Representatives, which seems very small, but as I'm sure we'll unpack a bit later on, the Netherlands has a fully proportional system, and 37 seats, particularly for the Freedom Party, is a pretty extraordinary result. Is that fair to say, Chern?
Yeah, I think similar my reaction to... And obviously there's a bigger gap when we did the preview episode for the Netherlands and the preview episode for Argentina. But similarly, I was not surprised that Geert Wilders potentially finished first, because the last polls did pertain to a very tight race and Geert Wilders was fighting for first place, but not this convincingly. I mean, let me just read out what the full results were. 37 seats up 20 with 23.7% of the vote. The second place, the Green Labour Alliance, has only 25 seats up 8 with 15.5% of the vote. So Sam, we're looking at a near 8-point difference in terms of share of the vote. And the Green Labour Alliance was led by none other than the former executive vice president of the European Commissioner, a man who topped the polls in the last European election, Frans Timmermans. So it was not just a close result. It was an absolute thumping, isn't it? And let's not even talk about the other two other contenders, the VVD, which was led in this election by Dylan Jasikow Tsagaris and is the party of the outgoing Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who has 24 seats down 10 with 15.2% of the vote, and a new social contract with its leader Peter Omzig, who enters Parliament with 20 seats with 12.8% of the vote. So all three parties, the Greens, the VVD, and a new social contract, were quite close to each other. But Geert Wilders just ran away with this election, isn't it?
Yeah, I think taking a step back before we start to unpack these parties' results, what the government formation will look like, how Geert Wilders did it, I think, Jern, it's worth saying that this entire electoral campaign, I think in some ways, was completely extraordinary, because you had four parties really competing for first place. You had four people who viably in some mathematical way could become prime minister, one of which spent half of the campaign saying that they didn't even want to be prime minister, which I'm sure we'll come on to unpack in a second. And then out of the blue, in the last few weeks of the campaign, the PVV's vote share in the opinion polls went from third or fourth place to an out and out first place in days. I've got some stats here that the between the 18th of November and election day on the 22nd of November, the PVV's polling went from 20% to the high 20s in 5 days in opinion polls. So there's something very peculiar going on, I think, in this Dutch election. And I wonder if a lot of it, which we did unpack a little bit in the preview podcast, as you said, a few weeks ago, is that Mark Rutte has been prime minister now for over a decade in the Netherlands. He's the longest serving Dutch prime minister. He's one of the longest serving prime ministers across Europe at this time. And we suggested that him leaving the stage of Dutch politics was potentially going to leave a massive void. And I think this election proved us to be right, which is that they did leave a void. And I think the Dutch public in general couldn't really decide what they wanted to fill it. And in the end, at the time when the election was actually held, it was the PVV who were leading that conversation. But throughout this campaign, there's been periods of NSC lead. There's been a period where Dylan Yezel-Gerst-Segarius thought that she could become prime minister, which didn't seem realistic a month ago. And Frans Timmermans throughout the whole time thought that he could rise gradually into first place and that never really materialised. But do you agree with me, Chern, that this whole campaign has been quite something and quite difficult to talk about, frankly?
Just rewind the clock. Not even like in June when Mark Rutte, when the government fell, who was leading the polls then? The farmer citizen movement that and they ended up with 7 seats up 6, but only 5% of the vote. At one point they were polling over 20% of the vote. So I think it does show that throughout this year there was a core element of the Dutch people that was just dissatisfied with how politics was going to run. And when the music stopped, Geert Wilders was the last man standing, and he benefited from that. But the thing I would like challenge you, Sam, is that we've known for a while that Mark Rutte is going to leave the scene. You know, he announced when the government fell that the snap election was called, that he would not run for this term. So people already knew that. So it wasn't as if they were just shopping around for a viable alternative. But one of the earthquakes I talked about in the last 5 days was the fact that a far-right candidate in Javier Milei won in Argentina. I wonder if some people looked at that and thought, I want a piece of that, potentially. And I think which group of people will look at that far result and say, I want a piece of that in terms of a far-right leader? Two groups. I do note, for example, that if I look outside the top 7 parties, which some of them we will talk into more detail, there were, in the 2021 election, there were 34 seats went to 10 parties. In this election, 8 parties won 23 seats. So there are less parties in the Dutch parliament than in 2021, and they won a smaller proportion of the seats, which suggests a certain level of consolidation. I would argue some of it went to Peter Omzig, some of it, a lot of it is other right-wing to far-right parties consolidating behind Geert Wilders' party. The Forum for Democracy, which was a big party in the Senate elections in 2019, only 31% of Forum for Democracy voters in 2021 voted for the Forum for Democracy in 2023. 29% of its voters voted for the PVV this time round. And the other one is, I looked at what is the PVV, Geert Wilders' party's biggest composition. 40% of voters voted PVV in the last election. 15% voted for the VVD, Mark Rutte's party, in the last election. And 12% did not vote in 2021 election. So I think some people potentially in those last crucial days, they looked potentially at what was happening in Argentina, electing a far-right president, liking that, and breaking that taboo potentially, and saying that we want a piece of that. And who would have consolidated behind? Other far-right part, other people who voted for the far-right, people who are disillusioned with politics, and people who are off the center-right in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, and an interesting insight into some of the voters as well. Chen, I'm going to put back to you a potential campaign explanation for this rise of PVV as well, and I'll see what you make of it, which is that, to put it into context, as I said earlier, on the 14th of November, an opinion poll put the PVV on 20%, and on the 18th of November, they were polling 26% that continued to rise into the high 20s for the last few days of the campaign. What was interesting, I think, is that in those days, on the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st of November, there was a debate held between the party leaders. And by all accounts, in the snap polling afterwards, Geert Wilders was one of the best performers on that debate stage. People felt convinced by him, particularly when he was putting his arguments up against Franz Timmermans, Dylan Yezelgaard-Segarra's, and Peter Omtzigt as well. So I wonder if it's actually one of those examples where the general election debates actually do play quite a significant role, because people had Geert Wilders right in front of them, telling them what he would do. The context of Argentina, I think, is important, because it felt like there was now hard evidence that those people can win elections. And then people decided over the next few days that they were going to put their cross in the PVV's box, which maybe they weren't going to do before, because after the 18th of November, the opinion poll results for the PVV were 26, 26, 27, 28, 29, 35, with it being the exit poll. So you really saw a very sharp rise in the days following those debates. And I just wonder if they maybe did make a difference.
I just quickly clarify, those are seats, not share the vote. I think that's very...
The opinion polls in the Netherlands tend to be conducted on seats because it's purely proportional and you can't do that.
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right that the debate performance was key as well. But I also wonder as well whether the flaws of the other parties also came into consideration as well. When you have migration as one of the top issues and cost of living issues, whilst Franz Timmermans might not be in Dutch politics for the last couple of years, he was in, you know, one of the most prominent figures in the EU. And you know, the EU's had a migration problem for many, many years. And I don't think being so publicly associated as the face of that helped him in this campaign whatsoever. I think Peter Omtzigt lost some ground after this evocating over whether he wanted to be prime minister or who his party wanted to be prime minister. Such a simple question you cannot even answer. I don't think it's a very good sign, potentially. And the other thing I know, two other factors I wrote down here, is that certainly in terms of rhetoric, Geert Wilders is less moderated. Some of his more controversial policies, particularly in toning his rhetoric against Muslims, potentially that helped paved the way for some of the VVD voters, which were the second biggest group, as I mentioned earlier, to facilitate that switch from the VVD to the PVV. And I do know something also very similar to what happened in Argentina. The VVD leader, Dylan Yezelgaard-Segarra, said that she would consider serving in the coalition alongside the Freedom Party. So it gave the institutional centre-right support that unfortunately backfired on her, and seemed to have benefited Geert Wilders. And the result was the largest post-war gain in the popular vote of any political party, excluding parties running for the first time. And Geert Wilders, it was the first time since World War II that the largest party did not come from the liberal, centre-right or centre-left European party family. Quite astonishing indeed.
I'm going to respond to a few of those. Firstly, being about Dilan Yezagar-Sagarius's declaration that she would be open to talking to the party, because you're absolutely right. I think that gives people almost the invitation to flirt with voting for the PVV and to feel like they're not that different from the VVD in terms of making that leap. And I think she almost normalized voting for the PVV rather than making that feel like an extreme option. I think that was helped by Geert Wilders' rhetoric as well, because he started talking in the closing days of the campaign about how he'd be willing to make concessions on some of his anti-Islam policies, because he said that there were more important priorities to talk about, which I think also helped, because some people were particularly afraid of those elements of the PVV platform. And then finally, I think we also have to remember, why did this election come about? What was the policy issue that divided the coalition parties going into this election? It was all about the VVD and its coalition partners disagreeing on refugee and immigration policy. When that is what is bleeding into this election and what is the reason for the election and one of the key dividing lines between the centre-right and this election, well, that is the bread and butter for the PVV. They love talking about immigration. They love talking about asylum seekers. It's where they can quite clearly make a dividing line between them, the centre-right and the centre-left, and in a way that they just can't engage as closely on if it was an economic-dominated election, if it was dominated by, I don't know, European policy, because they stand out on a limb massively on European policy. This was a much easier for them to engage with, and also gave them a big platform to talk about it. And I think the VVD and Dilan Yezagar-Sagarius were never able to shift the narrative onto something else, especially with what was going on in Gaza, the continuing fallout in Ukraine as well. Just immigration and refugee and asylum seeker issues were completely dominant throughout this election, and that played right into the hands of the PVV.
And don't forget as well, Netherlands, like many other Western European countries, have a housing crisis as well. And I think it's very easy to look at immigration as being one of the causes of that. And the general economic cost of living crisis, it's very easy for immigration touches a nerve, particularly in hard times. And Geert Wilders is the original, you know, if you want somebody to be anti-immigrant, he is the original anti-immigrant party and person that is associated with it. So you cannot run away from it. Whereas Dilan Yezagar-Sagarius, yes, she was a new face, but she was running on a 13-year-old government. And I think as to a large extent, she had a reasonable election result. The VVD is, you know, performed in those respects, given the where it was several months ago, pretty respectfully, I would argue. Maybe not received the height that it once thought it might, but it was a pretty respectful performance. They were polling about 14% of the vote. So she has large parts held on and prevented, and she's improved that little bit marginally at 15%. So I think on the context, you had one big win in Geert Wilders. Sam, who is the biggest loser out of these four big contenders, three other big contenders? Is it the Greens Labour leader, Frans Timmermans? Is it the VVD leader, Dilan Yezagar-Sagarius, who I argue I don't think was biggest loser out of three? Or was it Peter Omtzigt?
I think that's quite a hard question, because I think all of them, for different reasons, were the biggest loser. Peter Omtzigt, I think it was a massive missed opportunity, because at one point, his new social contract party was polling first place. They were dominating conversations about this election. It was almost seen as inevitable that they would be coming out as the largest party. And that's why he kept being questioned about whether he wanted to be prime minister and continuously maintained that he wasn't sure or didn't want to. And I think that completely imploded his campaign. So in some respects, Peter Omtzigt. In other respects, I think the Green Labour Party will be incredibly disappointed, because the main motivation for those two parties joining together was to try and maximise their potential to become the largest party. And yes, they gained 8 seats to sit on 25 seats, but I think for a party that is an alliance between two recently historically, large parties, to only, as a combination, finish in second place 12 seats away from the people in first, I think will be a disappointment, because as you said, it was a 13-year-old...
And more importantly, going to this election with a heavy weight, isn't it? Exactly. They went into this election for heavyweight.
Exactly. They picked a candidate who was a well-known figure across Dutch and European politics. They were going against Mark Rutte leaving the scene after a decade-plus old government and got completely outflanked, not on the left, but on a further right party. And I think they will be incredibly disappointed that they weren't able to coalesce more of the support of the left. And then you've got the VVD, who I think Dylan Yersel-Gerius at one point thought that she could potentially rise above the fray. The VVD becomes sort of the party of stable government, the party of rationality in this debate, and they completely missed that opportunity. But I think you're absolutely right that the VVD, all things considered, should be pretty happy with this performance, given that the PVV was taking votes from them, the NSC were taking votes from them, and they were coming off the back of being in government for four terms. So it's pretty respectable. But yeah, I think all of them in some ways lost.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well for the NSC, I would be particularly worried because this party, like in many ways, like Geert Wilders, is an entirely personality-driven party. Peter Omtzigt seems to be the glue holding it together because they took votes across the political spectrum. I saw an exit poll breakdown. 25% of the NSC votes came from the CDA, the Christian Democrats, 17% from the VVD, 15% from the D66. So they didn't rely on one support base. They just drew a lot of support bases together. And I think without Peter Omtzigt, this list has the potential to fall apart very quickly. And from the Green Labour's point of view, why didn't they do so well? I think, look at the statistics, I think of two parties, which I think they thought that they could draw a lot more votes, but ended up didn't at drawing that many, as to a large extent, votes that they could have. One of them was, I would argue, the D66. Now, the D66 did fall to its lowest result since 2006, but it was only 27% of those voting for the D66 in 2021 voted for the party again in 2023. 31% of the 2021 D66 supporters voted for the Green Labour Alliance. But I still think that, I think in heart, I feel like as a centre to centre left party, I feel that the Labour Green Alliance felt they could have captured more of that vote than the 33% that they managed to capture. And the other was the Socialists. The Socialists received, so that's a group that's even further left to the Green Labour Alliance. The Socialists received its worst ever result in the national election since 1992, with only 33% of its 2021 voters remaining with the Socialists. 16%, the second largest group, did not shift to the centre-left Green Labour Alliance. What did they do? They voted for Geert Wilders' PVV. I think that's very interesting. And I think Green Labour would be particularly disappointed with that.
Chen, I think this should lead naturally on to the biggest question after this election is, who is going to lead this government? What will it look like? And is it even possible that a stable governing arrangement could come out of this? Or could we be staring down the barrel of another election in the Netherlands?
Well, there will be another election because Netherlands... But the question is, I think the easiest conclusion is made as I don't think this next government can last 4 years. Will you bet that this government can last its full term of whatever stripe, Sam?
I mean, I highly doubt it, but that's mainly because I don't really see what comes of this that could be quite stable, because Dylan Yersel-Gerius has already said that the VVD will not be going into any formal arrangement with the PVV. Frans Timmermans' Green Labour Alliance certainly won't be going into it. So already, two of the biggest parties are completely removed from the equation, formally. So what's left?
That being said, that's a good question. That being said, Dylan Yersel-Gerius 24 hours later partially reversed that position. So I think push come to shove, this likely government is likely to be a PVV, VVD, NSC, BBB government. And BBB, I think, shares that same anti-establishment right wing because, of course, they gained a lot of popularity in the Senate elections on the back of the nitrogen issue in rural Netherlands. So I think they share the same anti-establishment populist right-wing base. So I think they could very much comfortably work with the PVV. I think the VVD in the end will probably go back into the coalition with Geert Wilders. And I think the NSC, Peter Omtzigt has said that he wants to have a government, or he wants to act in a national interest and the interest of governability. So suggesting that I don't think he's completely averse to work to ensuring there's some ministerial support or there is some confidence in supply to the PVV, at least in the short term, I would say. And Sam, since World War II, do you know how many times that the largest party has not governed the Netherlands?
I would go as far to say maybe never.
Three times. 1972, 77, and 82. All three times was when the Labour Party was the largest party, I should add. So this is not one of those occasions. It's been over 30 to 40 years, so I don't think that's likely to happen. And crucially as well, Sam, if we were to take the PVV out of the equation, I can't see a centre-to-centre-left government for me. You might get Frans Timmermans, Peter Omtzigt, which would bring the 45 seats, the D66, 54 seats. You then have to start getting the VVD involved. And I just don't think the VVD wants to be involved in a Frans Timmermans-led government. So you're then having to go to smaller parties like the Christian Democrats, Christian Unions. It would just be a complete, even more ungovernable arrangement, isn't it?
Yeah, I think really the thing that's mostly going in the favour of Geert Wilders is, at least in the short term, being able to form this right-wing government that consists of his party, the VVD, the New Social Contract, and the Farm Assistance Movement, is just that there's not really a realistic alternative at this point. So I think if we are going to see a coalition formed from the initial coalition negotiations, it kind of has to be that, because I just don't see an alternative coming around unless the VVD really does not want the PVV in government and agrees to, I don't know, confidence and supply Frans Timmermans purely on installing him in power and nothing else. But that's not exactly a stable governing arrangement, and I'm not sure Dylan Jessica-Sigarius will go for that, given that we haven't talked much about her. But I can't see a situation in which she doesn't continue to lead the VVD after this election, given that it's a fairly respectable performance. So she'll be putting her eyes on, when this next election comes around, I'm going to be a contender to be the Netherlands' first female prime minister. So I think a lot of her calculations here will be, what is the best thing for me to do to put me in the best position for the next election?
Well, and I think that's, and it was with that calculation why she said initially she wanted to stay out of this government coalition, because the last time that Geert Wilders supported the government was Mark Rutte's first premiership. It was a three-party coalition between the VVD, the CDA, with outside support of the PVV. And what happened? It collapsed within 2 years, and many people punished Geert Wilders for collapsing the government as well. I think she's hoping that Geert Wilders' personality would just naturally collapse the government with infighting, and the VVD could benefit from that. So that's why I think she initially said she'd stay out, only for the mathematics of, to form a government necessitating some kind of VVD involvement.
And I think, finally, Chern, you touched on this a little bit earlier as well, but the New Social Contract has 20 members in this House of Representatives. But we don't know a huge amount about these 20 members. We also don't particularly know that they ideologically agree on everything, because most of the New Social Contract's platform was more about constitutional issues and functioning of government rather than day-to-day domestic policy and financial policy or immigration policy or like general ideological approach. So we don't even know that these 20 members will all agree with everything that their party does every time. It's a similar story to we had with En Marche when they first came into power in France. Is these people haven't come from an ideological tradition. They've come from discontent with the existing arrangement and gravitated around Peter Omtzigt. So if this government does come about, can we rely time and time again that all 20 members of the New Social Contract will vote for everything this government does? I don't know if we can answer that question yet.
Or to be honest, what a Geert Wilders government will look like in terms of other ministers, because Geert Wilders is the PVV. It's a one-man band, really. Yes, there might be some ideological closeness in terms of his policy position in regarding to asylum seekers, Ukraine, immigration, European policy. But there really isn't much of a party apparatus beyond or part or notable party members below Geert Wilders. For example, Sam, I can tell you the PVV list was only 45 members long, and 37 of them have been elected to parliament. So there's not a lot. So that shows you to what extent they outperform internal expectations, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, yeah. And Jen, something's just come to me, which is that the Dutch electoral system is designed to encourage coalitions to be as proportional as you possibly can be, to make sure ideological perspectives are represented, to make sure that parties work together, which is designed to be the complete antithesis to a presidentialization of politics that is around personalities. But that is exactly the opposite of what happened in this election, where Timmermans, Omtzigt, Jessel Gelsegerius, and Geert Wilders all ran, in some ways, a presidentialized campaign. And I think that is going to be the downfall of how extensive these coalition negotiations will need to be, because they ran campaigns that were not designed for exactly what the Dutch parliamentary system is designed to create.
I mean, you talk about that rise. I mean, look at, I asked this question earlier because I've been struggling with the whole week. Who was the biggest loser at this election? One of the biggest losers is Mark Rutte. Look at how the VVD performed. The other coalition, the D66, performed. They got 9 seats down 15 from 6% of the vote. The CDA got 5 seats down 10 to 3.3% of the vote. The worst score in the party's history. And the Christian Union also lost seats. All four parties lost seats. I think that is the Dutch people giving its verdict, isn't it, of the last 13 years.
But there is one positive for Mark Rutte here.
Go on.
Is that I think his tenure as the longest serving Dutch Prime Minister will only continue to grow, because he will be Prime Minister throughout this period while they're trying to negotiate a new government. So if anything, he will be extending his record.
But the question is that I remember one of the stats when you were learning A-level politics is that the Belgian government took over 500 days to form a government. I can recite that verbatim. Do I potentially have to update that statistic, Sam?
Well, we shall see. It took in 2021. Over 200 days. So who knows?
And exactly. And I wonder as well, with personality-driven politics, it's a lot harder sometimes to form a government, isn't it? Because you have to placate egos rather than necessary form a common policy position, isn't it? Let alone form a common policy position, isn't it, Sam?
Exactly, exactly. A lot of politicking to come, I think, in the Netherlands.
So, Sam, let's just round off very quickly. If you could give your takeaways or reflection on these two sets of elections, what would they be, very quickly?
I think one of the takeaways is that discontent with the incumbent, particularly over a long period of time, as we've seen both in the decade-plus-long premiership of Mark Rutte, and also, with the exception of that four-year period, a pretty extensive run of Peronist, Kirchnerist, Fernandez dominated politics in Argentina, that discontent can manifest itself into pretty extremist elements of the political system in those countries, which we've seen in Javier Milei and now again in Geert Wilders as well. And I think a lot of people on the more centrist elements of those political systems think that it's not possible that the far right and extremist elements can win those elections. And I think both of these elections now have proven that that is possible. And we're potentially staring down the barrel of, certainly Javier Milei, but pretty likely Geert Wilders as well, having the top job in politics in their respective countries. So I think that's one of the biggest takeaways, is that discontent can manifest itself in some of the most extreme ways.
Yeah, and Geert Wilders, whilst they share any notable hairstyles, one would argue, Geert Wilders has been a fixture of Dutch politics, having been once a member of the VVD and a member of parliament since 1998. So he's been a while, unlike Javier Milei, who burst onto the political scene 2 years ago. I think my final reflection is, 10 years ago, particularly in Europe, we talked about the pacification of the traditional centre-left. A lot of centre-left, it's old working-class voters going to the far right. I think right now, the traditional centre-right with these two elections have a crisis on their hands, because both parts and traditional center-right parties, the Juntos por el Cambio coalition in Argentina and the Christian Democrats and to a lesser extent the VVD, performed poorly to a certain different extent. And both these elections, they tried to counter their slide in support by adopting some of the most right-wing policy positions and rhetoric. And the result is more of their voters seem to have voted for the far right. It seems like the people in their coalition, the right or center, who they thought they could keep in the 10 by shifting and adopting their rhetoric and policies, seem to want the original product rather than the product that has shifted and shifted over time. So I think that's interesting to see that the center right is in a bit of crisis, like 10 years ago, the center left was. And I don't think they have the answer to what of how to cure that and to reverse this slide in support. Don't you, Sam?
Yeah, and I mean, if opinion polls are anything to go by, I think there's more countries who'll be having that conversation in the next few years as well, notably Germany. The AfD is going to loftier heights than I think the CDU ever thought they would be capable of, and they're going to have to come up with an answer to it if they're going to be able to combat them being a major fixture of German politics as well. So it's not isolated to these two countries and is something that I think we'll be talking about and could become a bit of a trend in 2024.
You're right. Germany's three-way traffic coalition is in a heap of trouble. Just look at the recent constitutional court ruling regarding its budget accounting, and the whole government's agenda seems to go out in smoke, really. And we're going to get an early test of the this theory of how the center-right responds in 2024, and can it reverse some of its woes? Or will similar patterns continue? Because Portugal is going to the polls early after the collapse of their government, the resignation of Prime Minister António Costa. But that is all to come. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we'll be reviewing the year in UK politics. And as always, we'll continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @Ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.